Hello, it's Thursday, July the 8th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, the government is probably going to ban the boiling of lobsters alive on the grounds of animal welfare. We're talking about the threat to Morrisons, one of our best-loved supermarkets, from yet another one of those private equity firms. Travel at last. We can go abroad and not have to quarantine for 10 days when we return from an amberless country, but you're still going to have to pay for a very expensive COVID test. But first, oh my word, did you watch it? I did. I'm still getting over the shock, cowering behind the sofa like I was watching a schoolboy episode of Doctor Who. Yes, we won. We're through to our first international knockout final since 1966. Football's coming home. At least we think it is. So England fans, in ecstasy after the Three Lions reached a major football final for the first time since, my word, 1966. And don't we all know that date? The national side beat Denmark 2-1 in front of a delirious crowd of 67,500 people at Wembley Stadium. I'm joined now by former England international Danny Mills, who was, of course, part of that 2002 World Cup squad. Danny, did you think it was ever going to happen? I mean, I was five when we won the World Cup in 1966, so I don't remember it. You're much younger than me. Did you ever think we were going to get to a final?
Well, I mean, there's always that hope, isn't there? But it's the hope that kills you. You know, I remember when I first, I suppose Euro 88 was one of my sort of initial ones. I remember World Cup 86, then 88 with Ruud Gullit and Van Basten, and of course Italia 90 was my first sort of really great memories of football, an iconic sort of world European competitions. And then of course Euro 96, when I was, I actually went to the Spain game. And I always say it's one of the last games I went to as a true fan before I sort of started my journey in football, if you like. And you always think, oh, we could. And then, of course, went through a little bit of a dearth and I played in some and hoped that we could get to those finals as well. And then we went through, obviously, we crashed out of the Euros against Iceland and it was all doom and gloom yet again. And then, you know, this knight in shining armour came riding over the hill after, you know, Sam Allardyce was sort of removed from the job quite quickly.
Right. Yeah.
For whatever reasons. I think it's still sort of quite unclear. And suddenly Gareth stepped in and a lot of people didn't want him to get the job. You know, said he was an FA yes man.
Yeah.
He was only there because it was the easy option. He was much cheaper than anybody else. He had no experience. But I followed Gareth's progress for the last 20 years. I've known him a long, long time. Seen how he works, seen how relentless and precise he is with everything that he does, and seen how this journey has gone from grassroots coach, sort of under 12 level in the local Harrogate League, you know, not that long ago, you know, under 10 years ago, to suddenly becoming the national manager and taking us to a World Cup semi, a Nations League semi, and now a Euro Championships final.
And as you may know, Danny, I don't know much about football, but I've become completely swept up in all the excitement and ecstasy. And I felt like I was watching Doctor Who as a child again. I thought, I've got to keep hiding behind the sofa because I was so nervous for the England team. It was like when the Daleks came on, hide behind the sofa because they were so scary. But I was really struck by how young this team is. One of those players is 17 and a half, but so many of them are in their either late teens or early 20s, which means this is a team that could go on and on and on and could become a real team of world beaters.
Well, many of them will have absolutely no recollection of Euro 96.
No, quite.
You know, and many of them weren't even born or even thought about being born, you know, at that stage in 96. And obviously Gareth, you know, has missed the penalty. Fantastic quote from Alan Shearer earlier in the week. You know, Gareth, you know, we don't think anything of it. You missed the penalty, end of. I think there's 13 players that have missed penalties in major competitions for England. But we all tend to remember Gareth Southgate. We forget about Lampard missing, Gerrard missing, Jamie Carragher missing, you know, sort of greats of English football. But what he's done, and I think you're the perfect example, is that people that weren't necessarily interested in football or weren't huge fans, he's brought them into football.
Absolutely.
Because he's made these players relevant in everyday life. You know, when I was playing under Sven, and then obviously later on there was Capello, can you imagine back then if a young player, you know, just coming into the squad, was he messing about on a multicoloured unicorn? You had players, you know, rolling around in the swimming pool fighting blow-up sharks.
Yeah.
And then you get knocked out of a tournament. It would have been front-page carnage. You know, players would have been ripped to shreds for that. They're not taking it seriously. They should be, you know, locked up and thinking football 24/7 and doing nothing else but that.
Yeah.
And I think Gareth has brought back a human nature to these players and a human facade that I think a lot of people had forgotten. And like you said, you know, we have to remember some of these 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old men playing in some of the most high-pressure, high-profile situations, greater than any of us will ever have to deal with, whether that be in our 30s, 40s or 50s. And they're dealing with it with immense credibility.
And can they go, the $6 million question, Danny, you've been there, you know what the pressures are like. They went behind last night, they conceded their first goal, but they stayed calm, they won, and they deserve to win, from what I could see. Can they beat Italy, who I suspect may start the match potentially as favourites? I'm not sure.
I think they will probably start the game as favourites, not in this country, because the bookies won't want to get stung. That is for sure. But I think in general, among football people, we understand that the Italians are a very, very good side. A lot of experience in that. But without a doubt, there is the talent and the ability to go and win this. You know, you're one game away. One big performance is all you need. Two great moments in the game, you know, to get you two goals. And we have players in abundance that can come up with that. But I think, again, you go back to the manager and the culture that he has developed across this team. As you said, went 1-0 down last night. Nobody panicked.
No.
Nobody got, you know, in the team. There's plenty of fans. I'm a little bit nervous, a little bit jittery. But they stuck to the plan. Went, no, this is what we do. And Gareth would have talked about that. You know, at some point, we are behind in the game. Well, this is what we do. It's not a problem. We keep playing. At the last 20 minutes of the game and the first half of extra time, they were absolutely superb.
Yeah.
And I know that if it does go all the way, extra time, and if it, you know, the dreaded penalties, there will be no better team prepared than England, because Gareth has been through it, and he's been through this preparation in a World Cup, and he's been through this preparation. He's been through this game and this scenario probably a million times in the last year, hoping and praying that he gets to play it out for real.
Absolutely. Well, we'll all be watching. We might be coming back to you, Danny, on Monday to have another chat, especially if they win. So,
if it's coming home, you're more than welcome.
We'll look forward to it. That's Danny Mills, former England international, who's also star player for Leeds United, of course. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. So, well, it was nerve-wracking for many of us, even more nerve-wracking for the sports desk, who had to put together that paper after England's extraordinary victory last night. Tim Nicholls is our deputy sports editor. Tim, you must have had your heart in your mouth the whole way through that match.
It was a nervy night.
Oh.
I think the whole country was probably feeling the same.
Oh, not much.
But, you know, England fans have been through many previous dramas, whether it's penalty defeat in Turin in 1990, Euro 96, we all know about David Beckham's red card in 98, the Portuguese winkers when Wayne Rooney got sent off in the 2006 World Cup. It's never easy being an England fan.
No.
We always find the hard way. And so I think probably people have woken up this morning still pinching themselves, still trying to process the fact that after 55 long years, England are finally back in a major tournament final. And it just saying those words feels strange, but wonderful as well.
And I was, because as you know, I'm a newcomer to watching football matches. This is only the second football match I've watched in probably 25 years.
Jumping on the bandwagon, Andrew.
Yeah, jumping on the, but no, I've been caught up in it completely, and I'm happy to say so. The crowd were extraordinary. I mean, apart from booing the Danish national anthem, which was just a small section of the crowd, I really wish they wouldn't do that. But the crowd must be like having a 12th man on the team, because they were really behind England. It made me proud to hear the roaring and the cheering them on. And it must give them a bit of an advantage.
Absolutely. I think look, the fact is this tournament has for England has pretty much been played at home. All of our games, bar the quarterfinal against Ukraine, have been at Wembley, and I think that has been a huge advantage for us. No, there's no denying it. But at the same time, you know, you've got to use that advantage for your own benefit. And you know, I always thought that the scenes at Euro 96 25 years ago would never be matched. I'm too young for 66, but Euro 96 was such an incredible time to be an England football fan. Yeah. It you know, it really felt like we were sort of coming together, and it was sort of the birth of this sort of new modern football, if you like. But people who were at Euro 96, people who were there last night and for the Germany game, I don't think you can compare the two. I think it's also you've got to recognise that it's been such a difficult year and for so many reasons, and just to be able to be in a crowd again and to be with your friends and your family and celebrating all together. And you know, I think personally, and if you'll just let me speak personally here, I think this country has needed something like this, because it's really, we've been divided for a long time, and I think that this has really brought everyone together again. People are forgetting their differences.
Yeah.
We know things have been tricky, particularly over the last 16, 17 months. And it's just, nothing beats England doing well in a major tournament. Nothing unites a country like it.
It is our national religion, football. And as I say, even if somebody like me has got completely swept up in it now, so I'm going to be watching the final on Sunday night with my partner. That's a first. We've never watched a football match together before. I don't think we've ever discussed a football match before. But the moment the match ended last night, I called him and said, it was amazing. He said, no, I'm going to be there. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it with you. And I'll have to hide behind the sofa again when it gets tense, because that's what I was doing.
It was nervy last night. Yeah. I think we were all, you know, it's never easy.
Ukraine was easy because it was, another goal. Yeah. Another goal. So I could just carry on with my conversation.
But that's the great thing about football and sport, really, Andrew. It is unscripted drama.
Mm.
You know, we all love box sets, and we all love, you know, great TV and films, but there is something about live sport. I would obviously say that, but it's the drama of it, whether it's Wimbledon Centre Court or Twickenham or Lords, Wembley, and it's brilliant.
And they showed in adversity, i.e. going a goal down, Kane not getting that penalty, which I think he deserved early on, but they stuck to their guns. and I see our friends in Scotland. I saw one Scottish newspaper today, the front page picture, claiming it wasn't a penalty. Get over it in Scotland. Get over it.
I think.
What about the hand of God of Maradona? We were robbed, but you have to get over it, don't you?
We've had our fair share of bad luck.
Yeah.
Whether it was a penalty or not, do you know what?
You make your luck.
I don't really mind whether it was a penalty or not. England have had bad luck in the past.
Yeah.
And look, Scotland being like that, it's all part of the fun.
Yes, it is.
It's all part of the fun. I'm sure they'll be ribbing us if we lose. We'll be ribbing
them
if we win.
I'm sure Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, is absolutely spitting tacks.
No doubt, but it's all part of the fun of the rivalry. You know, sport wouldn't be what it is without that, without those rivalries.
And you've got to gear up your department to do it all over again on Sunday for Monday, because the match ended about 10:35 and the paper was away within half an hour.
It was
amazing.
You know, you get used to it in covering big football matches, but there's nothing quite like it. I mean, nobody certainly on our sports desk has experienced that before, because it's 55 years since we got to a final. But we'll be ready again to do it on Sunday night for what is, you know, the will be the highlight of our careers, you know, from our point of view. From working for a newspaper, we'll never get this. Hopefully we will get this again, but we've never had it before. It's an honour and a privilege. And, you know, we will be determined to produce a fantastic section, and hopefully England will win.
Yeah, and the mood in the country, fantastic. That is our very fine Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls talking about a landmark moment in our sporting life, because it's the first time we've reached a final of an international knockout competition since 1966. Summer holidays abroad could be back on for many, so the government's finally announced that double jab people will not have to self-isolate when arriving back in the country from amber countries from July the 19th, the so-called Freedom Day. However, travellers will still have to take a pre-departure test 3 days before they go, and a PCR test on or before day two, adding hundreds of pounds to the price of holidays. Henry Smith is the chairman of the Future Aviation Group, and he's the Conservative MP for Crawley. Henry Smith, hugely important, this development, not least for your constituency, which is slap bang in Gatwick Airport's catchment area, where you've got presumably many constituents working in the aviation industry.
This is really good news. It really means a meaningful reopening of international travel, and really the hope is that we can save as many aviation and travel sector jobs as possible as a result of this. But in the House of Commons today, I also urged the Transport Secretary to be more ambitious, particularly I think opening up those transatlantic routes to the United States, where every day that we don't have meaningful travel between the UK and America, it costs the British economy an estimated £23 million a day. So it is important that we acknowledge this is a positive step and a degree of getting back to normality, but we need a more expanded green list of countries, and we also need to start having a less complex and a less expensive testing regime.
The Transport Secretary couldn't resist it. They can't just give us the good news, can they? Because he did also say, Henry, and you'd have heard him say that guidance to people travelling to amberless countries, he's warning that an amberless country could still turn red. Now, that could put people off booking that holiday.
There is still a great deal of uncertainty in the industry, and therefore it's quite understandable that many people will be reticent about booking a holiday or indeed travelling to see family or for business reasons. And we do need to have a much more expanded green list and a simpler testing regime to allow that. I'm not against there being a red list for those countries that are of most concern. It's absolutely right that we should be protecting public health in this country, but we do need a much more pragmatic approach to international travel. For those who are fully vaccinated and going to countries with a similar or lower infection rate and a similar or even higher vaccination level, it is effectively safe to travel, and for the sake of our economy, not to mention our freedom and getting back to normal, seeing family and so forth, we do need to have that expanded travel possible at the earliest opportunity.
What do you say to those people, though, Henry, who say the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, in his own words, has warned that actually infections could go up to 100,000 a day? So some people are arguing this is exactly the wrong time to relax the travel restrictions. We should keep them in place to stop people coming in and to stop people here going abroad and picking up another variant.
Well, I'd say several things to that. First of all, predictions have been fairly inaccurate over the course of the last 16 months. So I'm very cautious about predictions. We had all sorts of doom predictions before the Brexit referendum, and none of those have come true. And I think we need to be very cautious about that. But I think the key point as far as public health is concerned is that the weakening of the link between serious illness and death when people are infected with COVID-19 because of the very successful vaccination program. You know, we're going to have to be living with COVID-19 probably for the rest of our lives, and it's about managing it through probably a rolling vaccination program and reducing that risk of death and serious illness. And also, there is still a red list of countries for those parts of the world where there are variants of concern that we're unsure of, where, you know, hotel quarantine is a requirement as well as comprehensive testing. So I do think there is a way we can safely reopen up a large part of international travel and at the same time keep public health to a very high standard in this country.
Just finally, Henry, where are you going to go on holiday now? Have you got your eyes somewhere? Somewhere hot, somewhere sunny?
Well, I would like to be able to travel to the US, and I hope that that may be possible before the end of this summer period. But I certainly will be looking to go abroad. not only to get a little bit of sun and warmth after this horrible summer so far, but also to support those aviation and travel sector jobs, which are worth some £38 billion to the UK economy. That's what outbound travel represents. And inbound travel represents some £28 billion to the UK economy when it's able to operate normally.
Very interesting. That's Henry Smith, chairman of the Future Aviation Group, and he's the Conservative MP for Crawley. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Time now for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, you've been writing some terrific stuff in the paper this week about the threat to Morrisons, which is one of our best-loved supermarkets. What's happening?
So what's happening is that Morrisons, which is one of the big four grocery chains, the big four supermarkets in the UK, is subject to a whole battery of bids from private equity, US private equity firms. Now, all of these, I believe, would be an absolutely terrible idea for not only for Morrisons shareholders who are getting really bad value from some of these offers, but also for Morrisons 110,000 employees, for all of the customers who shop at Morrisons, and not least for us as taxpayers, and also actually for the agricultural sector in the UK, because what a lot of people don't realise is that Morrisons actually has its own farms, it's got its own fishing boats, it's a big player in the agricultural sector in this country, and all of that would be quite vulnerable if it were to fall to private equity. What's happened is they initially had a bid from a company called Clayton, Dubilier & Rice. They rejected that. Another bid came in from a consortium led by an outfit called Fortress. And so that they accepted. And then there's a third one from an outfit called Apollo. I hope you're keeping up with all of this.
Yeah.
It's a little bit tangled. So Apollo haven't actually yet made a formal offer, but their former boss was booted out because he made huge payments for so-called tax advice to none other than the late Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, vile. So, the paedophile.
Not exactly the late paedophile. So not exactly the most savoury situation, really, there.
What can be done, Ruth, to resist it? Because we know that private equity companies, I'm sure some of them are noble and admirable, and certain, I'm sure some of the people who work for them are too. But what they care about is one thing, profit, which probably means they'll put prices up. Is there nobody within the board of the supermarket chain who can stand up to these people and see them off? Or am I just being, is that pie in the sky?
Well, you know, I hope that that's what's going to happen. As usual, Andrew, you've hit the nail on the head and asked absolutely the right question. The board's duty in any company, Morrison included, is to do the best thing for shareholders and for broader stakeholders, for society, for consumers.
Yeah.
It's not to do the thing that will be most immediately enriching for themselves. Now, unfortunately, what happens in bids, including private equity bids, is that the board, the executives, stand usually to get huge jackpots if they accept. So in the case of these bids for Morrisons, the chief executive would be in line for around £90 million because his share awards and options would all cash in. So he's got, you know, I'm sure he's a very, very honourable guy.
Yes.
But he's got this massive temptation and incentive to accept a bid. Now, set against that, if he rejected the bids and made sure that Morrisons performed well over the longer term, that could actually be even more lucrative for him in the long run, because it would lead to even more share-related returns. But unfortunately, I think people like a bird in the hand, really, don't they?
I fear they do. You do wonder, Morrisons, of course, was a family-run firm many years.
Was, yeah.
How the great man who founded it, Mr. Morrison, I've forgotten his first name, was it Ken?
Sir Ken,
he'd be spinning in his grave, wouldn't he?
I think he would absolutely be spinning in his grave. Sir Ken Morrison was actually the second generation of the Morrisons family. He built Morrison's, the chain, in his own image. So he was a frugal, plain-spoken northerner. He did not like debt. He detested debt. Morrison's owns most of its own stores freehold, which is unusual. He believed in sustainable supply chains. He believed in good old-fashioned northern value. Now, all of that has just plumpened Morrison's up like a chicken for these private equity bidders just waiting to be plucked. You know, he would absolutely be spinning in his grave. He really would. I'm sure he is.
Yeah, well, let's hope they're seen off, Ruth. And that's Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. So boiling lobsters alive could be banned under new animal welfare laws, with the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs commissioning a report into the issue of how much pain crabs and lobsters really feel. Boiling lobsters is already banned in several other countries, and animal welfare charities are saying they should be killed in a more humane manner, such as with an electric gun or by chilling them in cold air before boiling. I'm joined now by Kate Werner, who's Senior Campaigns Manager with PETA. This is an interesting story, Kate. A lot of people detect in this move within the government the influence of the Prime Minister's wife, Carrie Symons, as was, because, as you know, she's a noted environmentalist and campaigner on subjects like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. She is. She was actually PETA's Person of the Year last year for her work to improve the rights of animals. We're really pleased, you know, to see that to see that lobsters and crabs and other crustaceans and mollusks were going to be included in the sentience bill. It's really welcome news. You know, scientifically and morally, it's the right thing to do. These animals are living, feeling beings, and they're able to experience pain and suffering, just like we do, just like other animals do. So, of course, they should be protected with animal welfare legislation.
And currently the legislation which we think they're going to write this into, this bill, only covers vertebrates, which are animals that have a backbone, not invertebrates such as lobsters, crabs and squids. Do we know, Kate, I mean, has research been done? How long does it, if a lobster is put into a pot of boiling water, how long before they die and what level of pain are they enduring?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that lobsters spend around 2 to 3 minutes suffering when they're put into a pot of boiling water. You know, they suffer immensely and excruciatingly during that time. They struggle and they fight until they die. You know, the scientific community has been saying for a long time that these animals are sentient. They have highly developed brains and nervous systems, and relatively larger brains actually than some fishes and reptiles, and sense organs that rival those invertebrates in terms of their complexity. So just because their physiology may differ to ours or to other animals, it doesn't mean that they're any less sentient or able to feel pain and suffer. So it's speciesism, really, to leave them out of this type of legislation, and we're pleased to see that they may be included now.
What also, I'm just curious about chilling them in cold air before boiling. What is, I don't know how that works, if you could explain that, but also why are the fishing industry unhappy with this proposal, Kate? What would be upsetting them? Why does it matter to them how these things are killed?
Mm-hmm. I think with the chilling, it's not certain that it does stun them. It may just make them immobile, but still that they are still able to feel pain when they're killed. So they just can't move is the issue there.
Right.
And with the fishing industry, you know, this regulation, the sentience bill, will have far-reaching consequences. So it will mean that these animals, when they're formally recognised as being sentient, they'll then need to be included in other animal welfare legislation. And to this point, they haven't been. So they could be caught, they could be slaughtered, handled, transported in a way that completely disregards their welfare. So it means that, you know, they will have, their welfare will have to be considered at the time of killing. They may have to be electrically stunned before they're killed. So it will mean reform for the fishing industry and for other industries too, because what we're doing here is saying these animals are sentient. You can no longer dismember them alive. You can no longer spike them in the head. You have to now consider that these animals are suffering when you do that, and we can't let that happen anymore.
In an ideal world, would your organisation ban fishing altogether?
Well, you know, we're very realistic. We would want fishermen to develop and to change the industry and to move away from killing and eating animals is, of course, our goal. And actually, you know, we don't have to wait for legislation to catch up. We can all take individual personal responsibility and stop eating sea life, which is what they are. You know, these animals aren't seafood, they're sea life, and we can all choose to leave them off our plates. We don't have to wait for the sentence, though.
All right. I just wonder, have you ever eaten lobster, Kate?
I haven't actually, ever.
Right.
No.
And would you not on those grounds because you think it's cruel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't eat any animals. And I would encourage people to try, you know, vegan alternatives to lobster and crab. They're out there and they're amazing and they're getting better all the time. It's never been easier to try vegan. And it's also, of course, better for the environment and better for human health, too. So, you know, we would say if anyone's interested, they can go to peace.org.uk and get a free vegan starter kit where they can learn all about alternatives to eating these animals.
All right, that's Kate Werner. She's the Senior Campaigns Manager for PETA. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.